Is that really like The middle a little bit more. Hi everybody. We're having technological issues here. There we go. Thank you. And I'm going to do, I thought I had resolved them. I was going to do slides, PowerPoint slides, and this morning one of the projectors stopped working and we just replaced the bulb and it stopped and that didn't. So now we're just going to have sort of this multimedia experience.
That's right.
And you'll have to bear with me at this point. I can't believe that certain somebody missed Elizabeth Catlett.
But I have certain friends that have certain recordings.
Oh, okay. I was a couple of comments. First of all, I want to explain a comment I made off the cuff last time we met, and I thought, oh my goodness, I'm really going to get in trouble. So I want to get myself out of hot water. I made a comment when we were talking about Elizabeth Catlett being blacklisted and not being allowed into the country and the kind of records that the government keeps. And I made a comment that sort of went like, well, the government has lots of records on me because I've been to Cuba so much. And then I said, and I wish all of you had a record. And then I went home and I thought, uh-oh. I'm going to really get into trouble. So this is what I meant. I've been to Cuba, I think it's 17 times. And I have been there legally 17 times. As a professor in the state system, I cannot afford to go to Cuba illegally because the administration has the ability to fine you and you have to join a class action suit and it's about, you know, $25,000, $40,000. So every time I've gone there legally. But that does not mean that my name is not in a file, because we do not have diplomatic relations with Cuba. So I want you all to understand that, yes, my name is in a file, absolutely, on both sides, both in Cuba and here, and they punch my name, and I always see them smile a little bit at the customs place on both sides of the border, because you know, I'm a known entity. I've curated shows, I've written books, whatever. What I meant, that's the first little footnote, get me out of hot water. Then the second footnote is I want to explain to you what I meant when I said, and I wish you all had a file. All I'm saying is I wish you all were politically active. I'm not telling you what causes I want you to be active about. It could be using Dove or Dial to clean the birds, right? But it just was a comment that, unfortunately, this generation, and I know I have people in the class from the age of probably 19 to I'm 63, right? But we're not known as an activist generation, particularly right now. So that comment was not meant to say, that comment was meant to say, I just wish you were all politically active in something. So clear that up. Okay? Now, I was not happy with the Elizabeth Catlett lecture. And so I had this whole week to moan and groan about it and lose sleep. And I realized one of the issues this semester for me personally is that this is my first semester on PowerPoint. And it is hours and hours of work transferring 2,500 slides that I have upstairs in a slide collection into PowerPoint. And what happened with the Elizabeth Catlett lecture is I just didn't transfer enough images. And I don't know which one of the brilliant young women in this class said to me, Dr. B, didn't she do anything about Mexico? Thank you so much. I pulled the Mexico slides. No, really. I mean, that was an important comment. So, but now they're out of order because one of the projectors is down and I did it for double projection. So I want to go back and I want to show you the Elizabeth Catlett slides, mostly the ones that they're lithographs or liner cuts. And I did check, and a restrike is definitely a word in printmaking. It means you just take the same plate and restrike it. I checked with two printmakers, so out of trouble there. And and then the other thing, oh yeah, I've had to, because of this PowerPoint issue and having the week off, I've had to change the sequence of lectures for this next 2 weeks. So if you're following the sequence, it's going to be different, but you're going to get everything that, and probably more than I originally intended. So today, after I show you the Elizabeth Catlett, I'm going to do my Australian Aborigine fusion art lecture. Because in order to do my Native American and the New York Mythmakers, I had to get about 20 more slides scanned today to make it a complete lecture. So all I'm doing is sort of at the end here, sort of trying not to run out of steam. So let's first look at these Catlett images. And this is really for your edification and then for me next time around to teach it more fully. How's the light? Good? Okay. So this is just that mother and child in plaster that we first looked at. This is the one she won the award in Chicago for. This is 1940, and it's 35 inches high. And I showed you, I think, a different view of it the last time. Now let's see if I can do this, Ryan. Then, if you recall the Charles White images, this is an Elizabeth Catlett. It's not a Charles White. But as a team, they were so important when they were young, as a team with their concerns and their style, that I thought I would show you this. This is Nurse, Red Cross Woman, 1944, so it's right there at World War II. And so that, and can you see that sculptural quality even in the painting here? That she really comes out as, you could see that her early training was in sculpture. When you look at this, is tempera on canvas, and it's 20 inches. So I don't know which. Okay, so now we're beginning, and then we'll change the carousel so you'll get the other one too. This is a group of images that she did in Mexico in the 1950s and 1960s. And what I did, because of the question, I don't know your name, I'm sorry, but that was asked of me, I pulled a group of these. They are all women because, as you know from my lecture, most of her series are about women. But this is not named women, and they're sort of generic types, much like the sharecropper that she did in the sort of African-American point of view. So these are, this is either liner cuts or lithographs, and this is simply called, I think this is called Raffaella, 1951. And this is, I don't have them both up at the same time. Let's just say this is Niña, meaning little child, and it's 19... No, this is Raffaella. This is Raffaella, and it's 19... Looks like 57 there to me. But it's in that 50s and early 60s period. But you can see that generically she's bringing out that sort of Indian-Mexican look, and she's using the rebozo as her icon of what it means to be Mexican. So like my rebozo today, right, from Oaxaca. So that's what it is. So that's what she's using in this, in her dedication to Mexican women. Okay, I need the other, just hold it down, go back to zero, pick it up and put the other one on. Oh, this is like grade school, right? I don't know what's wrong with the projector. I have to get, we put in a new bulb and it doesn't seem to be working. So. It's not one thing, it's another. And when I used to teach only with slides, I would always make the comment that women used to make about architecture too, that this was obviously designed by men because I have to stand on the arms of the chair to even reach it. There's, you know, no women. Woman Whitney's a little taller than I am, but I mean, it was obviously designed by a tall man who forgot that professors might be shorter women. You can't get it back to zero?
No, I got it.
Okay, thanks. Sorry, this is... I was going to be so good at two different types of... I really had it down, and then... Want me to advance it and see what happens, Ryan? No, I don't think you held it down, but I'll try. Okay, so this is now War Writer 1944. But again, can you feel that sculptural quality in the face that we were talking about, you know, her enormous debt to sculpture as, in the beginning of her career and then at the end and in the middle with the three children she does the printmaking. So if that was, I don't know, Rebozo's 1968. And again, to me, what is important here is she has an icon that she uses to make these women Mexican, and that's the rebozo, the shawl. So each one of the series that I'm showing you that sort of somebody said to me, you know, what did she do in Mexico? It was women, and here they are. And this is, can you see that this is an Indian-Mexican child just by looking at the face? So the name of this one is The Right to Eat, and it's a 1952 line of cut, linoleum cut, really. So it's one of her earlier pieces, again, when she first started working at the Taller de Gráfica. Okay, that was it. Thank you. So now let's go to Australian Aboriginal art in PowerPoint. Okay, did it? That was just to round out. I just felt like I didn't want to leave it hanging. Oh, no, I didn't. This is page... page 26 in your study guide. Yeah. And then at the end, I'm going to go back to slides because, well, you'll see why. Anyway, didn't have time to make them all into PowerPoint. So what do? I have to choose number three, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm there, right? Okay, so Aboriginal art, here we go. How come it's not Oh, it's input one. Input three is video, yeah. Right? Right?
I think so too.
It's acting like it's too hot, and we haven't even used it.
We haven't even used it, and it's gone. This is like totally and completely a bad day. And I got up at 5:30 a.m. No, look, it's not on.
You want to open the door?
Yeah. You could open the door. And everybody blow.
I feel like I'm doomed.
We should just all go home and sleep.
No. If I got up at 5:30 to do all this, you have to stay here.
I'll show you in Aboriginal Heart, California.
I mean, I just worked so hard today.
But shall we start? Shall we try to turn the power on again? So let me give you backup while we're waiting for the slides to come on, okay? It's still not working? Okay. So this is Australia, folks. And I'm talking only about the Aboriginal population. I want you to understand that Aborigines is the legal official name of the people. It is their choice name, but it is always with a capital A. So Australian Aborigines are two capital A's. There were 500,000 counted in the 18th century, and by the 1970s, there were only 180,000. And those figures are probably off. They were probably much more originally. But the Australian Aborigines were not counted in any Australian census until the late 1970s. I mean, apartheid reigned supreme. South African-style apartheid really reigned supreme in Australia. The Australian Aboriginal people are the owners of their own land. Politically, they have made lots of connections with American Indians because they feel that they have so much culturally and politically in common with them. They were what is called removed, is the expression. They were removed to government towns. They were forced to live in those government towns and are still very actively fighting for their land rights and their cultural rights. They were a fascinating people to the anthropologists and psychologists like Sigmund Freud, who wrote Totem and Taboo. They were heavily studied in the late 1800s and throughout the early 1900s. The aspect of their religion that is very important to understanding them is something that I'm going to call dreaming. And it's down here under important concepts, words. Do you see it on that page? You think that's going to go on tonight at all? Think I can teach at all?
15 minutes.
Or
I'll just keep on trying.
Okay. Yeah, maybe. That would be great. Thanks. When Freud published Totem and Taboo in 1912, Australia and the Aboriginal population was quite the vogue. And original culture became a testing ground, in a sense, for concept of totemism, the interpretation of dreams, primitivism, myth, etc., etc. This concept of dreaming in older texts is referred to as dream time, which the Aboriginal population, now that we have this, an educated in the college system Aboriginal population, there are a lot of commentaries that are coming out, and they prefer the word dreaming. Dreaming is possessing sacred significance. Dreams are entities whose movements and activities produced the features of our landscape. So again, it's this idea of being tied to the land.
Say that one more time.
Oh. my tape recorder does not go backwards.
How about the part where that possessing sacred?
Okay, got it. sacred significance. Possessing sacred significance. And being tied to the land at these sites, S-I-T-E-S, these are power sites for Aboriginal people who are believers. So there are, they look at their land and they see the landscape in a way that you and I could not see it. They see these power sites. They can walk to them. They know where they're located. And walking to these power sites is one of their most important activities. Bruce Chapman wrote a novel based on Aboriginal walking, and I recommend it. C-H-A-T-W-I-N. He was an art historian who gave up doing art history and wrote sort of evidence-based novels, is the best way I can put it. So you have people who know their land, know their landscape, in their belief system, they see their own power sites. As a group of people, they walk to these power sites, and they understand them, and their own communally. And I think that's the other thing that's important. So Dreamings is a cultural historical primer through which each generation conveys its own heritage. So you learn your tribes, you learn your clan's dreamings. They are taught to you orally and visually, and that's what we're going to learn about in the art. So the people occupy this book, in which their history is written. And the ritual rites over these dreamings are part of communal lodges made up of both men and women. And you own the dreaming designs of your communal lodge. So you'll see in a moment why you have to understand this when you see how the art is developing, okay? So it's a very, very important concept. To understand, I'm getting rid of those slides, okay?
Wait, so it's not working? The fan is out.
Yeah, but somebody said if we don't wait 15 minutes, it'll keep going. Remember the time it kept going off and on?
So. How much does a little fan cost to attach it up there?
I know.
50% off.
Okay, so there are two geographical areas in Australia that we're going to be dealing with. We'll basically begin to deal with the northern coast of Australia, which is called Arnhem Land. And it's a very wet, very wooded area. And so most of the art from that area is rock painting or pictographs on rock. And then we'll also spend most of our time in the central desert area of Australia. And that's where the dreamings began to be painted on the ground. And then they were both stone paintings and ground paintings under the advice of anthropologists at the end of the 1800s, but really in the early 1900s, were transferred to bark. So you have really important older bark paintings that I hope we get to look at. And then you get the transferring of the bark images onto paper and eventually onto canvas. And since the whole idea, the second part of this course, is cultures and fusion, right, I'm going to try to explain to you how you get the transferring of a more stable, traditional artistic endeavor that is destroyed, which is the central desert paintings on the ground, or that is preserved today in national forest areas, which are the paintings on the stone, how that transferred first to bark and then to paper, and then joined up in the international art world. By 1912, a major collection of bark paintings was made, and they were sent to the major museum and repository in Melbourne, Australia. In as early as 1877, a Lutheran church mission was established in central Australia in the desert area, and the major town in, if you want to look at a map, is called Alice Springs. So today, if you want to visit Aboriginal townships, you can fly into Alice Springs because it's Australia is at least as large as the United States, I believe, or maybe a little smaller, but people don't drive from coast to coast. People take airplanes. It's a fair, and the whole center of the country is desert. So during World War II, during World War I, Aboriginal artists started lining up on the few roads that were there. And then in World War II, Australia was a main site of activity during World War II. Some of you, if you have grandfathers who were in the Pacific Campaign, you might ask them if they were stationed in Australia or in Papua New Guinea. Because I do find that sometimes students in my classes say, oh, we have a bark painting at home that my grandfather bought while he was in the service. What happened was during World War I and then a lot during World War II, because it was a major campaign site, the artists would set up little tables on major highway routes or near airports, and they began to sell their bark paintings first and then their paintings on paper to as a tourist commodity, really, transferring the images as a tourist commodity. They also painted their boomerangs, and perhaps you all have commercially know what a boomerang is. And I'm going to teach you, if the images ever come up, what a chiringa is, which is a more sacred implement. It's an incised implement, and sometimes the designs on them are replicated in paintings. I really can't do it without the slides. So let me do one more thing, and then we're going to try the slides. By 1959, a town named Papunya was established. Yeah, it's on page 26. And Papunya became, again, it's 150 miles from Alice Springs, became a center of Central Australian artistic activity. And it was basically a welfare town where Aboriginal peoples could live and collect welfare from the government. This was the last major push of the gathering in policy of the mid-1900s. So you had a lot of different tribes and clans who were pushed together to live in these welfare towns in the central desert area of Australia. And here goes nothing. So first power, right?
Can we shut the door?
Let's try. You know, could you leave it open just a crack?
Yes.
Thank you.
Well,
lecture, it'll warm you up.
Do they do that in church? Like, keep the room cold so everyone stays awake?
I don't go to church.
Yeah. I know, I don't go to church either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's like fanning themselves constantly.
That's a different kind of church.
So
I'm glad you all are so understanding, because I find this all relatively ludicrous. Now, we're going to go back to one. So far, so good. So just to, please stay with me, folks. Okay, just to show you where we are in the world, okay? If you don't know where Australia is, they just had an election, I think. Over the weekend, we found the results. So this is Micronesia up here. This is Asia right here. Here's Australia. It was founded as a British penal colony first. You know, it's funny. Did this slide change?
No.
No.
There.
Okay, so now you get it with Papua New Guinea is right above it. And it's really interesting. I've been to both Australia and Papua New Guinea, and nobody in Australia that I know had ever been to Papua New Guinea. They were scared to death of it. Well, the people were just a bit darker in color. If you look at pictures, you will understand what I'm saying. Melanesians are very, very dark people. They are not African people. It's really interesting. They're very, very dark. From the original population came from the subcontinent of India area.
Okay.
But they do have curly hair and darker skin. It's fascinating. And okay, so just to show you, we're going to see PowerPoint is not that good. So this is Arnhem Land up. It's totally out of focus. Arnhem Land is up here, and I'm going to first go here, and then I'm going to go to the Central Desert area there. So this is just some views of the Central Desert area. Geography is so important to this art. So I really need you to sort of understand the visually, at least, the geography a bit. There's the Central Desert. Here's the Central Desert again. So it's real desert. I mean, towns are 75, 150 miles apart. And these are all, you know, government-established towns. The original people lived in their own settlements where they owned their own land.
No,
this is Central Australia. Now we're up near the water, and you can see how verdant it is, and there's rocks on the north coast and caves, etc. And so this is, again, this would be the north coast, completely different geographically and ecologically. And because of that, the art is different. Although the basis of the art, the whole idea of the dreamings is the same. And here you get some of the documented early rock art. You can see this is in the overhang of a cave. It's at the northern coast. And here are some anthropologists in the 1950s looking at what I just showed you in close-up. These same, you see, they have Aboriginal guides with them. So this is how this was documented in the beginning. And again, you see how it's really, you know, art on rocks that, and so people would make migrations to these. They were like pilgrimage sites is the best way to think of them. And I just want to show you, this is a sort of a standardized rock painting, very controversial. Most books are going to call these X-ray paintings. And this is because you can see the interior and the exterior at the same time. And so we're dealing with fish. This is, you know, rivers. This is the northern coast. For some reason that I have yet quite to understand after all my years of trying, many people feel that X-ray paintings is a derogatory word, that it simplifies too much this style of painting. I don't see that, but I want you to be aware of that fact that you might hear people talking and they would feel that this was a derogatory way. I find it fascinating that you see the inside and the functioning systems as well as the outside. This is always related to shamanic art. If you take shamanic art from Asia across to the, you know, to Alaska and down the coast, you will find that the art of shamans usually has this simultaneous interior, exterior, sort of stylistic gloss to it, because a shaman is also a medicine man. There's a reason that the cowboys called certain people medicine men. They were doctors, but they were shamanistic doctors. And shamans have to know in their doctoral capacity how systems work if they cure. And shamanistic religion is also a religion that has to do with curing systems. So that's sort of the origin of this kind of style of art. In Alaska, you'll see bears. You won't see fish. You'll see bears that have interior and exterior views. So this is, and then I want to show you this, which is, this was published in 1992, And those two gentlemen, you can see what Aboriginals now look like, were the last members of their clan to know the entire history of this particular site that they're photographed in. And that these are limited access sites now, as much as, you know, forest rangers can make it limited access. Because people were literally, when you do rubbings from sites, you start destroying the original sites. So things like that were happening. Bike trails, bikers, things like that. So this is the northern style of painting that has to do with their clan history and their clan religion. And here you have, on the bottom image, is what I'm going to be talking about now, is the Sheringa. This is, you know, one of the most important, it's as important as any altar that has ever been. The Sheringa is a piece of stone that has been carved, has been incised. I can't find it, but I know it by heart. And here is one of these Sheringas, okay? The motifs on this Sheringa tell the story of a dreaming. They are paths. They are paths of history, of mythology, of energy. But they can only be interpreted by somebody called a song man. So the leader, the sort of historical religious leader of each clan, who owns the clan's Sheringas, is named a song man. And here you have a song man holding the Sheringa. It's mnemonic. When you hold a Sheringa, it triggers the lessons you have learned. But you have to be trained in those lessons. I would hold it and it wouldn't trigger the lessons, right? You have to have this history of culture that you've been prepared for since you were quite young. So this is the role of the song man in the society. And he's called a song man in the English language because he chants, right? He sings. He sings history. But it's all related. Each clan has their own designs and therefore their own songs. And it's very important that you understand the sort of graphics of this, because that's what we're going to then talk about when we get to the painting. So these are incised lines and incised designs. And then, miraculously, I found in a very old anthropology book this particular photograph. So again, this is one of those power sites that I was talking about that people would make pilgrimages to. So this is like the lines on the Sheringa, but on in the natural environment. So this would be a very, very, very sacred spot for whichever clan owned it. And the Australian government literally paid no attention to all of that history and that legality. So here we have a 1932 photograph of the transferring of sacred designs onto paper so the anthropologists could take them home. Okay? So here we just have documentation of that transferring to paper of the sacred motifs and to bark. So this is really the origin of bark paintings. Now, Aboriginal bark paintings usually sell at all tourist stores, and I know doctor's offices own them a lot. They're almost as ubiquitous as Navajo sand paintings are in doctor's offices or waiting rooms. Have you ever seen framed bark paintings? Some of you have, I think. So, but bark paintings as an aesthetic act was introduced by the anthropologists. And then it was figured out that this was a way that people could actually make some money from their art. So you get the transfer of these linear motifs by the anthropologists to bark. And so this is, again, bark painting of a huntsman in pursuit of a kangaroo carrying a spear thrower. Right? Obviously sold to tourists. And by the Second World War, this became a commodity that was sought after, and it became the sort of the first step in putting Aboriginal painting, as it were, on the map in terms of the international art world. And you can see also in that kangaroo that idea of the exterior and interior view simultaneously. Yes?
When did it become a commodity?
Well, by World War II, when they were setting up these little stores along highways and at train stations, et cetera, et cetera. And that's when this photograph is from also. Here are some more bark paintings. And this, I just want to show you, there are many, many books that are published that give you all of the myths that are demonstrated in these bark paintings. And what people don't tell you, and what the Aborigines, of course, didn't tell the people who are writing sort of these tourist books, is that not all the myths were true, and things were left out. It's like I have a wonderful film that I own that I show in my Native American class that takes all of the footage that, anyway, he's the most famous photographer of the quote-unquote vanishing race, and I just saw his posters outside for sale. Anyway, he did photographs and movies, and they found out that the Hopi Indians that did the snake dance and two other dances for him performed everything backwards. So that all of this great documentation that was at the Smithsonian and Natural History Museums, nobody's going to come up with the name of this photographer, so famous. This is what happens is I go off on these little footnotes, and then, of course, the proper name is... anyway, so everything was incorrect. So this is what's happening here. You're going to see these great books with these great reproductions and all of their history, and everything's going to be sort of slanted a bit incorrectly, because they're not going to give away all their secrets. They're not going to tell you everything, period. So these are what bark paintings look like. I had a hard time with this one. I couldn't figure out which way was up and which way was down. And I just left it like this because you see the human figures here? Just flipping it, but I left it this way because of these human figures. This was definitely done for the tourist market because Aborigines would never, they were interested in abstraction. Their art, as you saw on the Chiringa, was an abstract art. So, this was obviously collected in order to be collected and painted in order to be collected. So we're really in the 1950s now. And now we're going to go to Central Australia. I'm going to jog your memory a moment. We're going to the area where the Yundumos live. They are the people you saw in the movie Magicien de la Terre. Okay? So I'm going back to some of those same people and some of their neighbors. I have to catch up with myself a moment. And we're now sort of on page 26. So the residents of this this forced town, the town that was established by the government, Papunya, realized the income that could be made by working with the missions as artists. And the missions acted as sort of the middle people. So it was the Aboriginals, the missions, and then the large galleries in Melbourne and Sydney. And more Aboriginals decided to work as artists. So here is what their towns look like. And here is the first official mural that was done on a surface that was a government-owned surface. This is the famous school in Papunya. And this is done in 1971. And I talk about that school in your study guide. This sort of very brilliant young man named Jeffrey Barden arrived in Papunya in 1971 and began a mural project with the people he was working with. He bought acrylic paint for them. And the elders then joined the school kids and the mothers in this tradition. This is the first documentation of transferring a dreaming to a government-owned surface, okay? And then they did this famous door. So this door was on the community school. This is about 1983 now. So between 1971 and 1972, 620 paintings are recorded as being produced and delivered to the Stewart Art Center in Alice Springs. I will say that, it's in your study guide right there, okay? So it's you can in 1 year's time, because the elders realized that they could transfer parts of their training as paintings and have some kind of income. This is a staggering event, really, in the history of art, that in this 1 year, this sort of outpouring of artistic energy happened on some permanent surface that we can then document. So I wanted to show you the eventual outcoming. I think this is sort of interesting. That was the school door in 1983. This I took from the New York Times in 2003. This is now a Yundumu community project, the Yundumu doors that were, you know, erected in the middle of the desert so that when the tourists come in, they drive in their four-wheel drive trucks, buses or whatever, you know, through this site. So it's taking that idea of that first door and just making it into a huge art project by the year 2003, and a very successful art project as that. So this is a story of success. Here you are inside one of the schools, and I don't know if you recall without the slides, but I was saying that clans, both women and men, have separate groups, but both groups have access to learning the dreamings so that the women can become artists and the men can become artists, but they usually do not do art together because their dreamings are sort of gender specific. So here you have a woman teaching the young children in the Yundumu community. This is the same community that was taken to Paris, right? And this is how the lessons are learned, right? So they've tried to transfer their traditional way of learning and knowledge to things that fit into a more Eurocentric kind of school system. And then this wonderful photograph where the women are dancing with a painting that was then intended to go to Paris. It's like a rites of passage for the painting itself as it's coming out of the community center, and then it's going to be wrapped up, et cetera, and taken to Paris. Here we go. This is what this ground drawing looked like at Magicien de la Terre in 1989, and it is by the Yundumu community. And here is what the paintings that were transferred to canvas begin to look like. So we're now in, these are called acrylic dot paintings. That's sort of the name that they're known by. If you type the acrylic dot paintings in, you'll get to Central Australia. And what happened is that this by the mid-1980s, Aboriginal groups realized they could really make a pretty good living selling these paintings. They were sold, let's see if I have that here. By the early 1980s, a famous acrylic painting could sell for $20,000. Well, that's probably up to $200,000 at least now of the more famous painters. So I'm going to go through and talk about some of the more famous painters now. But there's one comment I would like to make. This has been successful, definitely. This is very much like American Indians in the sense that these people still live in whatever home they can build in these sort of gathering in townships. But they might own four-wheel drive vehicles, satellite television dishes, you know, all sorts of accoutrements, but they refuse to move because they are still completely fighting for their land. The only right they have left is to refuse to move. So they could move into a city, or they, you know, could move into sort of facilities where closer to electricity, whatever, but they absolutely refuse to. So again, there's been the information about these people is a little skewed, because magazines love to publish a family living inside, living, you know, standing beside their home, which the magazines are going to call a shack, and then they're going to have the four-wheel drive and the satellite dish, and the magazines don't explain that there's a political reason that these people refuse to leave these sort of constructed towns. And I wanted you all to understand that, too, that this is the last thing they have left is the fight for their land, and I'll go into that in a minute. So here we see them working on a dreaming. Here we see a woman's group. Now, this is members of the Yindumu community, but remember, the women didn't go to Paris, if you remember the film, right? Only the men were allowed to travel to Paris. But here they are doing their... And do you see how graphically this relates to the motifs on the Chiringa? So we're dealing with an abstraction that you and I cannot read, but they can read completely. That's the other point I want to make. This is a understandable, readable abstraction to those people who are part of the culture. Again, this is Woman's Ground Design, 1985.
With the ground designs, is the shaman only supposed to read it too, or is that...
No, no. Anybody who's initiated at a certain level in those clans that I talked about, who are part of the sort of the elders, is a good word to use.
Okay.
So it's the elders of each clan who know their own history, who can take those walks, who can pick out things in the landscape and then transfer it to a ground painting, which then would be transferred to paper or canvas and sold. But things would be left out in that translation process, deliberately left out. This is an image you saw before, right? Yes. It is a language, but it's an abstract visual language that can be read by those in the know. Does that make sense? You and I could never read it. We could never sing the song.
But it's an abstraction to us.
No, to them, it's... I see what you're saying.
You see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah. Yeah, I do understand what you're saying. Let me think about this for a second. Yes, they understand the formal attributes in a way that we don't. You are right on that. So there is a linguistic issue here. And that's why I think that idea how to translate the word dreaming is so important, that I started out with, is you can't give it... That word in the Yoronda language, is one of the tribes here, cannot be translated easily, and that's why I went into that whole explication of what it means. Yeah.
So when they talk about the dreaming or the dream time,
let me just let you look at this when we're doing it. Okay.
Okay.
Let's call it dreamings.
Dreamings. Is it has to do more with the subconscious? Is it more from a meditative state, or is it an actual?
It's about experience? No. What is the ones I've read are concerned with power sites in the landscape and beings that I'm not going to define more than entities,
right,
that inhabit the power sites areas. And the idea is that these entities are our ultimate ancestors. So that's where totemic comes in here. That's why the anthropologists use the word totemic, totem and taboo. But it's actually an incorrect... The word totem is also very controversial. Like, I talk about this a lot in my Native American class, that what we know as totem poles are not totems. But in our understanding, in the Western understanding, yes, they are totemic in that those ancestors... Those entities are ultimately the ancestors, and they occupy the spaces, right, that are here. Does that make sense? So these are really good questions. Thank you for asking them. So here we have, if you look at your study guide, Aboriginal last names are ferocious, okay? And I'm going to sometimes say to you that if you know that this is Maggie, I don't mean this demeaningly. It's just that I don't even know how to pronounce her last name, and I'd rather just not mutilate it, okay? So this is a woman doing, and do you see how she, I'll get to you in a second. Do you, I don't know if you remember the film, but I feel like we should see it again. But she's using a stick with a little bit of paint on the end, and that's why they're acrylic dot paintings. The entire painting is, and I have a close-up coming up also, is produced by dotting techniques. Question?
I just was wondering what the, if there was any difference between the word totemic and its attributes and what we kind of say is metaphysical, or is there like a difference between the two?
You know, I'm not the right person to ask about the word metaphysical because I really have no idea what it means, and I'm not being facetious. I would never use it in lecture because it would, I don't know. Sorry. I don't understand it, so I don't use it. It's the best way not to get to trouble. Yes, question.
So you said to refer, like if we're thinking about her as Maggie, but are you going to tell us which family she's from?
No. No, not yet. I'm going to do the men who have made it to the blue chip art world. None of the women have. You'll see. This is sort of the general introduction to how these paintings are done. So they're done also communally, and here's the first man. He has the jacket on, and he has the little yellow tam, and you saw him also in Paris. This is Uta Uta Jangala, and that's a pretty easy name. So I know how to say it, right? So this is Uta Uta Jangala directing his clan members on work on an acrylic painting. This was published in the New York Times Magazine. What?
Oh, no, sorry.
Published in the New York Times Magazine in 1988, but the painting was done in 1981. So this is really that burst of productivity and when the prices started going higher and higher. Right about now. And you can see again, these are in our language abstracted motifs. And here we have a transfer of those kinds of motifs. This says, the title is Old Man Dreaming. Again, this is Uta Uta Jangala, 1983. And what you see here are what? Now, what are these? I just taught it to you. Chiringas. Okay? So what he's done is he's taken those stone chiringas and used them as the basis for this design element, but I guarantee you that these designs are not the exact designs on the stone chiringas. You wouldn't hold, a songman couldn't hold this, and it couldn't sort of instigate the chant of the knowledge. So Uta Uta Jangala, it is Australian, it is Aboriginal, there's a recognizable motif and a recognizable style. And that's what makes it Australian Aboriginal art. And then this is that same background that you saw on the ground, the idea of wandering and walking to power sites. So this is Old Man Dreaming, 1983. Here is a shield, also done by Uta Uta Jangala, that a commercial shield that he painted. And here's that boomerang form, right? So the question that arises here is, this is a style that becomes known as Australian Aboriginal art. And the Australian Aboriginal people from the Central Desert area believe they own this art style. Now, some of you might know of other peoples in the world who feel they own certain styles of art. And then we get into a contemporary art situation where people say, you can't own a style, right? I can appropriate anything you're doing into my own artwork. Isn't that what postmodernism did, right, in the 80s also? So what happens is this is recognizable as Australian Aboriginal acrylic dot paintings, and yet everything I'm showing you is from the Central Desert area, none of it was produced in an urban setting. And what happened in Australia is some non-Aboriginal artist started doing paintings like this and selling them at galleries as Australian art. Didn't dare use the word Aboriginal, but started calling it Australian art. So there's a lot of really interesting literature about this problem, because who owns art styles? And how do you talk about art styles in terms of ethnicities? Could I paint in Elizabeth Catlett style? You know, could I do an Elizabeth Catlett print? And what would happen if I wanted to sell it in the style of Elizabeth Catlett? So this is something I want you to think about. This is cultures in fusion, right? This is the whole sort of second part of the class. I'm trying to bring out important issues. Not that I have an answer to these issues, but I think they are issues that art historians and people in art classes should begin to discuss. So this is acrylic on canvas, 1981. Again, Uta Uta Jangala. I'm sort of starring him because he's considered one of the founders of this art style, right? He's sort of the grand master from the central desert area of this art style. And everything I'm showing you is in collections in Australian National Museums today also.
What's this one called?
Doesn't make any difference. It's called Yumari. I have no idea. I would never ask you the title. Okay? Can you see the similarities with the previous paintings? Okay? Again, Uta Uta Jangala. 1982, acrylic on canvas, collection of the South Australian Museum. So Uta Uta Jangala becomes the grand master of the style. And his clan, that body of painters that I showed you in the beginning, and they sort of established the vocabulary of the style in the international art market. And then I have a close-up here, and if you remember the movie where they showed a close-up also, so this is just a close-up. These, can you imagine how long it takes to do these paintings? They are all done with dots. So what we're presented with is a phenomena. This is the second artist I'm going to tell you about. It's so easy. This style is nothing like Uta Uta Jangala. Look at it. Okay? You will be able to tell them apart. Don't get freaked out. All right? I'm not going to ask you the names of these paintings. This is sort of the second person who becomes very well known. His name is Theo Brown. And again, I'll tell you the name of it, but the names are generic. The names are there to satisfy the market. Okay? This is Wichita Grub Dreaming at Mount Zeal. It doesn't matter, right? This is the market needs a title, and the title has to sound exotic, and the title has to relate to what the market thinks the religion is. And all these factors are being successfully manipulated by these Aboriginal artists. So this is Theo Brown, 1986. And this is he working on one of his paintings. You see, he has the radiating center, and it doesn't have the sort of lines and the circles that Uta Uta Jangala has. Every clan has their particular sub-style within this acrylic dot painting tradition. Okay? And here he is. This is his brother, Mike. No, this is not his brother. This is another person from his tribe, Michael Giacomara, at the Sydney Opera House. He was commissioned to paint the floor of the Sydney Opera House. It came out terrible, but anyway. So let's talk again about the political. Let me just go back 1 second. I want to read you something. This is Michael Giacomara, and he's also from Papunya. You do not have to write this down. So this is an interview with him, and I want to read it to you. You've got canvas, paint, and brush. First, you're going to ask your father what to do. They'll say, you do that dreaming there, which is belonging to your grandfather and father. They'll give you a clue. They'll show you a drawing on the ground. You've got it in your brain now. You know it because you've seen your father in a ceremony with that painting on his body and the one on the ground. You'll see it, and then you'll know it. Right? You'll start, and you'll do a painting. And if you make a mistake, well, you got to ask again. You got to ask your father. So in this interview, he tells you how this knowledge is transferred, how the style is learned, right? It was a body painting. It was a ground painting. They saw it ceremonially, and then they transfer this. So that's, again, part of the argument that the Aboriginal population makes about owning a particular style. Okay, that's sort of the basis of some of their argument for literally the owning of an art style, which is very, very contentious issue. It's complicated, to say the least. So I have two bad PowerPoints, but I want to show you this. This is 1988. I want to go to the early one. This is 1963. So this is the Yirrkala Bark petition of 1963. And basically, what it is a petition that was submitted to the government about the rights of the Aborigines to own their land. So what you see here are, okay, this is, where was this style popular? No. It's not a dot painting style. It's that bark and stone style from the northern coastal area. No, not the desert. The northern coast. Right? The desert had complete abstractions. The northern coast had the kangaroos and the fish and things like that. Okay. So they're using that style. And just a tiny bit here. 1963, the bark petition. To the Honorable Speaker and members of the House of the Representatives in Parliament. The humble petition of the undersigned Aboriginal people of Yirrkala, being members of, and then they name 25 tribes. That nearly 500 people of the above tribes are residents of the land excised from the Aboriginal reserve in Arnhem Land. That the procedures of the excision of this land and the fate of the people on it were never explained to them beforehand and were kept secret from them. That when welfare officers and government officials came to inform them the decisions taken without them and against them, they did not undertake to convey to the government the feelings of the Yirrkala Aboriginal people, etc., etc., etc. So my point here is that these petitions are, so here's a petition from a more central area, right? So these petitions, which are legal documents, use the art style to make them legal to the people involved. So these art styles are something deeply rooted in the traditions of the Aboriginal people themselves. But everything I've been telling you today, up till now, is rural. These were rural people that made it into the art world, made it into the art market. And then there is a huge problem. What happens with Aboriginal people who live in urban centers, right? What is their art like, and is it different? And yes, it definitely is different. So I decided I'll show you a few pieces that have been reproduced of urban Aboriginal art, and then we'll go to the slides and you'll see this fabulous contemporary urban artists who I'm going to end with. So I just have a few of these images. Are they listed? No, they're not listed in the book at all. So I just want you to look at them. They're all political, right? Everything that is being done in the urban centers, I think you can understand it. This is a piece called Lost Heritage, 1986. It's a screen print. And it, you don't have to memorize the names. It's by a woman named Alice Hinton. But again, you know, it's using styles and mechanisms that are familiar to you as art students or familiar to people who are going to be going to urban galleries. Here's another one, a fellow Australian, 1985, a color screen print. Here's another one, Death in Custody, 1987, acrylic painting. So here, the artist has tried to sort of use a central desert style and just sort of, you know, update it in the sense of figurative elements and a political statement. Because those paintings from the central desert area would never sell for $200,000 if they were politically figurative paintings, let's face it. They made it in the art market because they're fascinating, but also the mythologies around them are very important. We'll put it that way, the way the market works. Screen print called Citizenship. And on this one, it's very important that we call them dog tags for our military. But what this is, oh, you were sitting. It says so right here. In 1944, Aborigines were allowed to become Australian citizens. Australian people called their citizenship paper dog tags. We had to be licensed to be called Australians. It's pretty staggering, 1944, right? Never included in a population census, nothing. Okay, so what I want to do now is... Oh, I want to show you this, an artist that I learned about 2 years ago, who's an Aboriginal, I'm going to close this down, an Aboriginal artist, and Ryan, we're going to have to switch over to the slides, didn't have time to transfer this to... And she does installation art. Yes, I'm sure. And she talks about the issues in Australia surrounding urbanity, surrounding the idea of an urban artist who is definitely Aboriginal but doesn't fit the mold of the rural Aboriginal person living in a desert township, etc. Her name is Fiona Fowley. And I actually discovered her online. There's a gallery in London that I'm very aware of, and and it's called the October Gallery, October Revolution, October Gallery, and they specialize in artists of the third and fourth worlds who are doing quote unquote contemporary art. No, I can't find it. Can't find it. Hang on. And did I leave any papers back there? Oh, thank you. And so I get all of their announcements, and I met them when I was in London, and after I downloaded. After I found out about these images and this artist, I started corresponding with them because I really thought she... I was not happy with just teaching you about rural artists, and I wanted to sort of update my lecture on Australian Aboriginal art, and I really feel that... I'll have to turn this off. Yes. So, we're going to... I don't care which carousel we start with because it's going to be so confused anyway.
I mean, the other one.
What? Just leave this on for a moment, and I'll just, it's just going to be really confusing because I've set it up perfectly, and now I have to go back and forth because we just couldn't get the projector to work. I couldn't get into this room before, you know, I was here 10 minutes before class. So this is, let me just talk about her. Fiona Foley, F-O-L-E-Y. A quote from her. All, you have to add this to your study guide, please. Oh. What do you mean, oh?
2 minutes over.
It's 2 minutes over.
I'm 2 minutes over. Oh, great, because then I'll get the slide projectors to work, and we'll do her on Thursday. Yes, thank you. Thanks for telling me. I'm so into this, I had no idea. This works out perfectly. Thank you. I had no idea. Yeah. See, sometimes I end early, sometimes I end late. What happened to you? I saw you in your bike the other day and you never showed up. You never came back.
I had to finish a project for a photo.
I couldn't believe it was working.
I know. I probably would have really enjoyed it too.
But you'll at least look at the e-reserves and...
And what I wanted to do, I have my flashcards. I want to set aside some time with you.
Sure.
To go over my flashcards.
When do you want to do that?
I don't know.
But didn't you have schedule conflicts?
Well, maybe sometime tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow I'm going to be here almost all day long. I have so much work to do. Right. Also for my Caribbean class, trying to get up to speed for the last 2 weeks on PowerPoint.